be afraid over there. But many times there's a verse in the Bible that has been a tremendous help to me. When the disciples were out on the sea and they were in dire straits, tremendous storm, looked like they were going to sink, all of a sudden Jesus appears walking on the sea, and he says to them, "Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid. Be of good cheer, it is I, be not afraid." So I think if you can believe that, and certainly we should, that we can get through the things that life throws up against us. Well, I talked about this earth being removed and about the end time events that were coming on us. I went from Matthew 23:37 all the way down to Matthew 23:3-35. I read about, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and you would not. Behold, your house is left until you're desolate." And it was left spiritually desolate, still is spiritually desolate, until this happens. "For I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth, till you shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." And I stopped there, where the promise of the second coming of Christ was going to be given. Well, this goes right on into chapter 24. I just read Matthew 23:37, but it continues right on into chapter 24. So I'll read the first three verses in chapter 24 and then verse 35. He's just told them he's going to leave the temple mound desolate, spiritually desolate. They will not see him as King Messiah until they see him coming in the name of the Lord, and that will be at the end of the tribulation period to rule and reign. Immediately afterwards, this is what happened. Matthew 24:1-3. "And Jesus went out and departed from the temple. And his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things?" Now remember, he has just got through telling a group of scribes and Pharisees and all those others who were there that they were going to have their temple mound left desolate, and that they would not see him henceforth till they saw him coming as king, which would of course be at the end of the tribulation period. Now he doesn't change the subject. "And his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things?" He's just been talking about it being made desolate. "Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now, he's about to tell them what he was just discoursing about in the last two verses of chapter 23. "And as he came upon the Mount of Olives, his disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? When is the temple going to be leveled? When is it going to be made desolate? When is all this going to happen?" He had just told them in the last two verses in chapter 37. And remember, there are no chapter divisions in the Bible. They were put there by the King James translators, and I'm glad they're there. But really, it's a continuous narrative. So he had just told them, he had said, "Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." It was going to be leveled. And he said, "You shall not see me henceforth, but you shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." So all of a sudden, he jumps all the way from the time he makes the temple desolate to his coming again at the end of the tribulation period. And now he's about to fill in those gaps by telling them what's going to happen in between. "And Jesus said to them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." He said, this is the desolation of the temple. "As he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, Tell us, when shall these things be? When, Lord, is the temple going to be leveled?" And he had just told them in 23:39 that they would not see him henceforth, though ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. He said, "And what shall be the sign of thy coming?" He just told them about the coming and of the end of the world. He said, when is the world going to end? So they asked him three questions. Now, remember what we were talking about back in Psalm 46. In Psalm 46, it says, "Therefore will not we fear, though the earth be removed and though the mountains be carried in the midst of the sea." Now we jump all the way down to the end of that chapter, 24, verse 35. "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away." We've got a lot of time between now and the beginning of the final heaven age. We've got a lot of time until there's a whole new heaven and a whole new earth. I know we've got at least 1,000 years. So we ought to be living for the Lord right now. If a person ever truly understands and believes what the purpose of his or her life is down here, then they'll serve God for the rest of their life. But until that dawns on them and they realize this is all true, it's not a fairy tale, it's true, then when they believe it's true, they'll start reacting to it, and they'll start realizing that all of this is going to pass away. You're not going to be married to the same person you're married to forever, nor is he going to be married to you or she to him. You're not going to have these same children all your life. There's coming a world in which there'll be relationships based on spiritual aspects, not on what we passed on from one another in the flesh. And this is real, and this is genuine. It's the only thing that's going to last. Spiritual things last, but physical things, they pass away. Heaven and earth shall pass away, and my words shall not pass away. Luke 21:33. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. Now I want you to notice in the same Olivet Discourse what Jesus said would be the sign of his coming. We already know the Temple Mount was made spiritually desolate when Jesus cast out the money changers and told them it had been turned into a den of thieves when it was supposed to be a house of prayer. But it was made physically desolate, physically destroyed, some 40 years later by Titus when he came down with the Roman legion. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. I'm sure that when Titus came in and he took over that temple, when he took over the city of Jerusalem, I'm sure he had a great feeling of triumph in him, and it was one of the happier moments of his life. He had won a great victory. Where is he now? We don't even know. We don't even know what's left of his bones. We have no idea where he is. Oh, maybe they've got him buried over in Italy, and I don't know about it. I don't keep up with that historical stuff. Maybe they do. But he's long gone. In your life, you've had some happy times. I'm sure you had a happy time when you were married. I'm sure you've enjoyed your married life at times. I'm sure everything's gone well for you. And I'm sure you've had some tragedies. But all that passes away. That's finished. All that is going to pass away. There's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. So you need to direct your life now in such a way that you are building up in heaven rewards for the life you live now in the flesh. And if you really believe all this and it's real to you, you will. Otherwise, you won't. Now, Jesus indicated that certain things would be happening to let us know when his coming was near. He said, "You shall not see me henceforth till you shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." He tells what's going to happen before his coming. He says, "And great earthquakes shall be in divers places, and famines, and pestilences, and fearful sights, and great signs shall there be from heaven." Now notice what he says next. "But before all these," now he's talking to the first New Testament church. It's standing right there. They're the ones that came to him. They're the ones he's addressing. He said, "But before the earthquakes, the famines, and the pestilences occur, they," meaning the enemies of the cross, "shall lay their hands on you, Peter, you, James, you, John, and persecute you, you, Bartholomew, you, Thomas, you, whoever, delivering you up to the synagogues and unto prisons, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake." That prophecy began to be fulfilled immediately after Jesus' resurrection from the dead and when they began to go out and preach the gospel. So that's already been fulfilled. But notice what he says. "But before all these," he said, "before they start arresting you and taking you up before kings and they start prosecuting you and persecuting you," he says, "before that," he said, "before the fearful," before, he said, "before these things happen, before they lay hands on you, before they persecute you, before they deliver you up to the synagogues, before they deliver you to prisons, before you're brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake," he said, "before all that," he said, "but before all these things I just mentioned," he said, "here's what's going to happen just before I come. Great earthquakes shall be in divers places, and famines and pestilences and fearful sights, and great signs shall there be from heaven." Well, you know, for the last several years, I've spent a great deal of time going to, oh Lord, over 700 of our churches talking about this. None of this had ever happened in this way in all of history. This is quite remarkable. Jesus said, all these are the beginning of sorrows, the earthquakes, famines, and pestilences. And he used the God-breathed word Odin for sorrows, meaning a woman's birth pangs. He said, when you see earthquakes and famines and pestilences start increasing like a woman's birth pangs, then you'll know I'm coming. Well, you've looked at these earthquake statistics over and over and over again. You can see what happened. You can see if you consider the smallest earthquakes, all earthquakes greater than one on the Richter scale. If you consider the intermediate range earthquakes, 4.5 to 4.9, you can see how they increased continuously. You can see the same increase in earthquakes 6.5 to 6.9. You can see the same increase in earthquakes 7 and greater. You can see that they've been steadily and constantly increasing. The pestilence, you can see the pestilence, and you can see how it has constantly lifted up. As I'm speaking to you, we have over 40 million cases right now of HIV on this planet. It has increased exactly like a woman's birth pains. The volcanic eruptions, you can see from the statistics I put here, and I've shown you two of them, show them to you many times, so I won't bore you with them again. You can see how the volcanic eruptions are continuing. I told you all 21 years ago that the ozone hole was being made larger by fluorocarbons from volcanic eruptions and not from man-made products. Well, we've eliminated fluorocarbons on the surface. And so look what's happened. It continually has increased. 1979, 2.5 million square kilometers for the size of the ozone hole. 1984, 6.0 million square kilometers. 1989, 9.5 million square kilometers. 1994, 23.5 million square kilometers. 1999, 27 million square kilometers. The year 2000, 28.3 million square kilometers. And still there is no ozone hole over the North Pole. And yet 75% of all ozone destroying particles are released in the Northern Hemisphere. But most of the world's volcanoes are located in the Southern Hemisphere. That's what's going to cause those noisome, grievous boils and sores that come on man when the vials of wrath are poured out. So I've spent a great deal of time showing you these things because I believe they're extremely important, because they let us know the coming of the Lord is near. Now, when Jesus gave the Olivet Discourse, he told them what would happen just before his coming. He said, now, but before this happens, he says, that's way on down the line. He says, Peter, James, John, Bartholomew, Thomas, he said, they're going to do something to you fellows. And if you've ever read the book of Acts and Paul's writings, you know this is exactly what they did. It's already been fulfilled. They shall lay their hands on you and persecute you, delivering you up to the synagogues and into prison, being brought before kings and rulers for my name's sake. Now, let's jump all the way down to Luke 21, 24. And we can see what happened when the temple was made physically desolate. It was made spiritually desolate by Christ when he was cut off and crucified. But it was made physically desolate by Titus when he came in and leveled it. Luke 21, 24. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, the nation of Israel, and shall be led away captive into all nations. They were in AD 70. And shall be led away captive into all nations. Now, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles. The city of Jerusalem will be trodden down of the Gentiles. For how long? Until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. The times of the Gentiles being fulfilled here, I believe, relate back to the city of Jerusalem. And I believe in June of 1967, for the first time, since the temple was destroyed in AD 70, the temple came back into Jewish hands. And for the first time, it was in Jewish autonomy. Now, the Jews control it. They have complete autonomy over it. But they allow the Arabs to maintain administrative control so they won't have a jihad. But the times the Gentiles were fulfilled in 1967, I believe, for the Temple Mount, I believe that's when the final generation began. And you know that I have said repeatedly that I believe the Lord will return before the year 2008. I have also told you repeatedly I could be dead wrong about that. It's by no means a certainty. It's merely an opinion on my part. But I am convinced in my own mind that he will be back before the year 2008, because this generation began, I believe, the last generation in 1967. Now, remember he said in Matthew 23:39, ye shall not see me henceforth till ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Okay, now, here comes the things that have to do with the coming of the Lord. And there shall be signs in the sun and in the moon and in the stars and upon the earth, distress of nations with perplexity. This is the latter portion of the tribulation period. I say this reverently, this is where all hell breaks loose. The sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming on the earth. And the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now, most people are hoping that I'm going to be dead wrong about this, and you won't see any of it. That's what most people are hoping. Particularly young married couples, they're hoping that they'll get to put in their full lifetime down here, and they'll get married, and they'll have children, and everything will, they'll all live happily ever after. Is that a possibility? Oh, yeah, it's a possibility. But what we all need to do, regardless of when the coming of Christ is going to be, is to watch. What does it mean to watch? It means to faithfully fulfill your guardship. It means that when you put someone on guard and you tell him to watch, he's supposed to stay physically awake so he can see the enemy. In our calling, it means to stay spiritually awake so you can realize the adversary's power and continually turn to God for strengthening from his word. It means to stay spiritually awake. Now, I honestly believe that most of you sitting here, maybe all of you, are going to get to see this, and it is not going to be pleasant. We get up every morning. We have a sort of a set routine, particularly if you're older. And if you're younger, like poor old April, her day is just a constant mess from sunrise to sunset. She runs around like a chicken with his head cut off. But that's a routine. You're used to it. You've known it all your life. It's hard to believe that's going to happen. But it is. I know it is. And I really believe it's going to happen in most of your lifetimes, maybe all of your lifetimes. And when it happens, it's going to be a real shockeroo. Well, what has been the advantage of you seeing all this? What has been the advantage to me of presenting this? Because when it happens, we won't be left out in a lurch. We won't be spiritually disadvantaged. We won't be panicky. We'll understand what's happening, but most people won't. Most people will have no concept whatsoever of what's happening, and they'll start looking for answers. I hope we can provide those answers, because that's a pretty frightening scenario. Men's hearts failing them for fear, for looking after those things which are coming on the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now, when these things come upon the earth, the real terrible things that I've just described, I believe they are the vials of wrath. I believe the vials of wrath are the wrath of God. The Bible says they are. I believe that the saved are going to be taken up on the blowing of the seventh trumpet. So you're not going to see all these sea and waves roaring and all the horrible part of it. You're going to see the beginning of it. You're going to see some terrible things happen on this earth. But just before this real hell breaks loose on earth, the pouring out of the seven vials of wrath, I think that's when the saved are caught out. And then we come back with him in verse 27. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now he tells you in verse 28 what you're supposed to do. And when these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your head, for your redemption draweth nigh. Does he mean that when these things begin to happen, you're supposed to just stand and look up in the heavens physically? No, he means you're supposed to start looking up spiritually. There's a spiritual life that a child of God leads, and there's a physical life that a child of God leads. A child of God that lives a physical life, you have to eat, you have to drink, you have to sleep, you have to rest. You have to have some form of entertainment, some form of relaxation. But brothers and sisters in Christ, it's when you let the flesh dominate your life and when it controls everything you do that problems arise. To look up means to look up spiritually, to keep your eyes fixed on the Lord. It means to keep your eyes fixed on spiritual things and to realize that these things are coming on the earth and to realize there is a heaven and an earth and there's going to be a new heaven and a new earth. It means to start investing your time and your life in serving God while you're here. That's what it means to look up. It means to quit looking down at the earth and letting everything on this earth control you and start being controlled by the Spirit of God as he leads you in the paths of life. Now, notice what he said next in verse 29. He said, and he spake to them a parable, the whole of the fig tree and all the trees. The fig tree is Israel. And all the trees are the rest of the nations of the earth, the Gentile nations. But he said, behold a fig tree, speaking of Israel. And then he says, all the other trees also, but particularly the fig tree, which is Israel. He says, when they, meaning Israel and the rest of the Gentile nations, when they now shoot forth, you see and know of your own selves that summer is now nigh at hand. He said, when you see leaves start to come on a fig tree, and you see leaves come on the other trees, he said, you know that summer is about to begin. Then he says, so likewise, when you shall see these things come to pass, know ye that the kingdom of God is nigh at hand. Well, these things started to come to pass with great intensity about 1967. That's when the earthquakes really started to rumble and roar. The pestilence came in the late 70s. The famines began to really be rampant in the late 80s. So all these things are coming to pass, and I can tell you the kingdom of God is nigh at hand. I have believed ever since 1967 that if you add 40 years to it, or maybe it was a little after 1967. I start believing this. I can't be sure, but it was not too long after 1967. I began to believe that if you added 40 years to 1967, that would take you up to the year 2007. And I started saying I believe Jesus would return before the year 2008. I still believe that. I realize that's a premise on my part. It's an opinion. It's an idea. It's a theory. It's not fact. But it's something that I think is worth considering because everything seems to be falling into a pattern. And if this generation he was talking about here is the last generation, then it fits. Verily, verily, I say unto you, this generation shall not pass away till all be fulfilled. Now, that word generation, I believe, is genea. And it can mean this age. But it can also mean a generation of 40 years. And Israel wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. This may mean 40 years. This generation, if it means 40 years, shall not pass away. Which generation is he talking about? The generation when these things begin to come to pass, whenever the earthquakes, famines, and pestilences begin to appear. From the time that happens and the actual domination of the Gentiles completely having autonomy over the Temple Mount ends, if you add 40 years to it, he says, this generation shall not pass away till all be fulfilled. What did he start off by saying? He said, behold, your house is left until you desolate. It was made spiritually desolate when he was crucified. It was made physically desolate after that when Titus overran it in AD 70. The times of the Gentiles for the Temple Mount domination by the Gentiles ended in 1967. If you add 40 years to that, you come out with 2007. He says this generation, if he's talking about that generation when all these things were going to come to pass, including the final terrible things, the pouring out of the vials of wrath, he says this generation shall not pass away till all be fulfilled. If he's talking about the last generation, and if it began, in 1967, then during the next 8 years, you're going to see all of this fulfilled. I realize I could be wrong. I keep telling you that because I don't want to be labeled a time setter, and I don't want to mislead you. But I do believe it's a very distinct possibility. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. That was the promise of the Lord. And I guarantee you, whatever this means, it's going to be fulfilled. But I do know that his coming is very, very near. I realize something now that I never realized before. things really change when you get old. No one can understand what it's like until you get there. No one can appreciate it. I realize now when you get older, you need some special help from the Lord. Like right now, I'm having a very difficult time when I bend my neck back. I'm getting dizzy. I've had normal blood pressure all my life. It's always been 130 over 80 constantly. Now it's up about 150 over 90. And I'm beginning to feel the effects of it. I'm beginning to feel circulation being cut off in different parts of my body. Well, what does that mean? It means I'm getting old. Now for the first time, I can empathize with young people. My speech is slurring. Imogene thinks I'm having many strokes. For all I know, she may be right. My grandmother Drennan had a lot of those before she died for years. But now I realize how much more you need the Lord when you're old. And you also begin to understand some other things. You always needed him. When you're young, you're so full of yourself and your own strength and your own ability that you try to be a helper of God. But when you get older, you have to do what the Lord told Peter. He said, Peter, when thou wast young, thou girdest thyself and carriedest thyself wherever thou wouldest. He said, but when thou art old, another thou shalt stretch forth thy hands, and another shall gird thee and carry thee where thou wouldest not. Terry came back the other night, and I was back there running off tapes, and those machines are very frustrating. If you could see, I have 9 machines back there that run off tapes, and I have them all wired in the back, and when you're young, your mind's very pliable and very quick, and you can wire things up, everything works fine, but when you get old and something goes wrong, you get very frustrated. So Terry came back and told Imogene, she said, Dad's out there talking to those machines, she said. She said, he's talking to those machines. He's talking to those machines out there. She said, well, what does this mean? I said, Imogene said, oh, that's all right. Well, what she didn't tell her, and what I didn't tell Imogene, I was talking to the Lord. I was stretching forth my hands like mad. And I said, Lord, I haven't got the foggiest idea what's wrong here. And it's about to drive me up the side of the wall. Would you please help me, Lord? And you know what? He does it. And he does it in very strange ways that I don't understand. But believe me, I have come to understand what it means to stretch forth your hands and trust the Lord. Because when you get old, you have to. Now, there's a point in me telling you all this. I'm not looking for sympathy or empathy from you at all. Matter of fact, I don't want that. What I do want you to understand is, don't wait until you get old before you start stretching forth your hands. Don't wait until your body gets worn out before you start realizing he's the only strength you've got. When I was Russell's age, he was the only strength I had. But I didn't realize it. When I was Kevin's age, he was the only strength I had. But I didn't realize it. I wish I could have realized it. All I can do is tell you, you need to start stretching forth your hands to the Lord from the day you get saved. Because he is the only true source of strength that exists. Don't wait until you get old. And when I was a young minister, first came here and you know, with all prayer requests and all those things, you know, I'd say, yeah, well, we'll pray for you. We'll do this for you. We'll do that, you know. But I didn't honestly realize how important it was to pray. And I didn't really understand that there was a hookup on the other end that was real and genuine and really heard all the prayers. Oh, I prayed, but it was just like, I'm praying this, but I'm going to take care of the problem, Lord. Now I just have to rely on the Lord to do it. You know what? He always took care of the problem. And usually when I got involved in it, I just messed it up. Well, let's take a look at Romans 10:17, because this goes along with that song. So then faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. And the apostle said unto the Lord, increase our faith. He just told them how many times they should forgive a man. 70 times 7, 490 times. Wow. You say, I can't do that. The Lord knows that. That's an exaggerated hyperbole. You say, well, God doesn't use exaggerated hyperboles. God uses exaggerated hyperboles all the time. And he uses them to teach a principle. He doesn't mean that you should forgive a man 490 times when he sins against you. You count up to 489, and then on the 490th time, you say, boy, I've been waiting all this time. Here comes 491. I'm going to let you have it right in the old smackaroo. No, it's an exaggerated hyperbole. And then he gives them an exaggerated hyperbole to answer the exaggerated hyperbole. And the apostle said unto him, Lord, increase our faith. They said, good grief, we can't forgive a man that many times. This is Luke 17, 5 through 10. And the Lord said, if you had faith as a grain of mustard seed, you would say to this sycamine tree, I believe that's a mulberry tree, blackberry tree, I think it's a mulberry tree, I'm not sure, but it doesn't matter. You might say to this sycamine tree, be thou plucked up by the root, and be thou planted in the sea, and it should obey. Now, I listen to preachers on television, and they say, why, if you just had enough faith, you could say to this tree, be thou removed in the sea, and it would pick up and go out in the river and go down. It would do just what God said. Problem is, you don't have enough faith. That is not what this is talking about at all. This is an exaggerated hyperbole. Did you ever see Jesus do something like that? Did you ever just see him put on a show so he could show how much power he had? Take a tree and cast it in the midst of the sea? Well, that would be just nothing but pure soul showmanship. No, he never did anything like that. That's an exaggerated hyperbole. Now, he tells them, here's how you increase your faith. He says, but which of you, having a servant plowing or feeding cattle, will say unto him, by and by, when he has come from the field, go and sit down to me. God called you to be a servant down here. You say, well, I don't want to be a servant. You are a servant. And God made you in your mother's womb. And God saved you. And God keeps you. You ought to be thankful to God you can be a servant. And the role of a servant ought to be something you accept without question, because the man who made you, your creator, is the man who saved you, and he's the one who keeps you. You ought to enjoy the role of a servant. Go and sit down to me, and will not rather say to him, make ready wherein I may sup, and gird thyself, and serve me till I have eaten and drunken, and afterward thou shalt eat and drink. Your reward comes later, not now. There are some preachers and some Christians who seemingly can't serve God unless he's continually blessing them every moment of their life. They just can't serve him. They've got to have constant reinforcement from God to be assured that he's there. But if you understand that heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away, and if you understand what we started with in the beginning of Psalm 46, though the heavens and earth be removed, and you understand that one day it's going to come your time, but right now you're working for the Lord, and will not rather say unto him, make ready wherein I may sup, and gird thyself, and serve me till I have eaten and drunken, and afterward thou shalt eat and drink. We are down here as God's instruments to collect the harvest. The biggest problem in the ministry that I had is what most preachers have. Thank God I realized it, and now it's something at least I can try to do something about by submission to God's Spirit. Doth he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? I thorough not. So you hear me all the time saying I've done over 700 missionary Baptist churches, preached in 20 different seminaries. You hear all this stuff I tell you I've done. That was merely my duty to do, and it wasn't near enough. God doesn't owe me anything. It's merely what he commanded me to do. He owes me absolutely nothing. I owe him everything. And that's the truth. Now take a look. So likewise ye, when you have done all those things which we have commanded you, say we are unprofitable servants. We have done that which was our duty to do. This word unprofitable, to me, is the keynote of Christian service. Because let me tell you precisely and exactly what the word means. Not needed. Pretty humiliating, isn't it? We are not needed servants. Man needs to understand that before he can serve God. A woman needs to understand that before she can serve God. God didn't need you. God can do quite well without you. And God doesn't need me. But we need God. I need God desperately. You need God desperately. And that's the truth. And if you realize that, then you'll serve him because you'll realize how much you need him. What's going to be left when you leave that body? Your house? your children, your possessions, your husband, your wife? What's going to be left? The Lord. He's the one you always needed. He's the one you need forever. Well, you belong to Him, and He won't leave you or forsake you. But serving God, attitude is important. And my attitude when God called me was totally opposite from what it should be. And I didn't know it. But I look upon myself now as what I am. This isn't false humility, it's just the truth. I'm an unprofitable servant. God has never needed me. Do you know, He can actually pick up things and put them out the sea if He wants. So the point is, if God can do all that, and if God can forgive someone 490 times, then how can I increase my faith? By having faith in Him. I have faith in someone who never stops forgiving after you're saved. I have faith in someone who can take a tree, command it, put it in the midst of the sea. That's the way your faith increases. When you realize who He is, the power He has, and how forgiving He is. And that's when you finally realize He never needed me at all. I'm thankful I discovered that. Because I would have always been afraid of failure. But I am a failure. And Jesus was a success. You can trust Him completely. Well, we'll just take a little short break here now.